The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
I'm your host, Beverly Prentice, and you're listening to Beyond, an hour-long program of science fiction, fantasy, myth, and adventure. If you enjoy the program, please drop a line to beyond3x5@gmail.com. Thank you. Wapato by Molly Gloss. Sheila and Don had long wanted to move to the island, so when Sheila got that severance from Nike, they bought an old house and barn on half a dozen acres just off Lucy Reeder Road. There were two oak trees just west of the house, and the country arborist told them the trees were 500 years old, at least, that Multnomah people had built summer houses under the trees long before Lewis and Clark had clapped eyes on the island. Before the dikes had been built in the 30s, the land below the barn used to flood, neighbors told them. They said a lake would form in October or November and hang on until March or April. So in early mornings in the winter, when spirals of fog rose up from the grass where that lake used to be, Don would say, "Old ghosts," like it was the ground remembering its past. In recent years, Sheila had begun to wonder if the oaks would live to see another 50 years. When they'd first moved to the island, there had been vast flocks of sandhill cranes coming through in the spring and fall, and dozens of osprey pairs nesting on poles along the channel. But in recent years, the birds had been fewer, and summers had sometimes carried on into November, dry and hot. The world was on its last legs, some people were saying, and there were times in the sultry red smoke of near or distant wildfires when she thought this might be true. But she was old herself now, and she didn't have any children or grandchildren to worry about. So let the world burn up, is what she thought. We deserve what's coming, but she did worry about the oak trees and her animals, and those shadows hanging around in her barn. She didn't know what those were exactly, but Don had always thought, like the fog, they were spirits from the before time. Well, Don had been some little part Umatilla or Cayuse, one of those tribes, a great-granddad on his mother's side, and when he spoke like that, Sheila thought it sounded like something a native person would think. They had bought the place from the nephew of an old bachelor, bought it as is, full of the old man's crappy furniture, and they found a trove of arrowheads and stone tools in the dresser drawers and the closets which the man must have turned up when he plowed. And bones. Holy Mother of God, Don had said when he'd come upon the bones in an old upright dresser. A small skull and a dozen bones, haphazardly thrown in a drawer, like they meant nothing, like they were just trash or scourings, indifferent souvenirs, not the remains of a human being who'd once been alive and loved and lost. It felt right to both of them, person to the earth. So Don built a box out of pieces of maple left over from when they'd floored an addition into their last house, and they laid the bones inside it, wrapped in an old baby quilt Sheila had made before they'd known there would be no babies. And they buried the box under the oaks. It was after they'd buried the bones that Don had come in from the yard, telling her he'd seen something down there, something hanging around in the corners of the barn. She had been a little unnerved by them in the early days, and for a while she'd called them those critters to manage that feeling. It was Don who began calling them familiars. Isn't that what people used to call a certain kind of spirit, a certain kind of ghost? He had asked her one day. It was in the first months after he died that she saw what they could do. She would be down in the barn, mucking out manure or spreading wood chips to soak up the mud puddles, something like that. And suddenly, Don would be there with her, alive in the world. It would be months or years earlier, and he'd be complaining mildly because, damn it, the animals were her idea, not his. Or they'd be talking about a neighbor they'd fallen out with, or sometimes not talking at all, just working alongside each other companionably. And then, after a while, she'd be alone again. But those slips of time had helped her get through the first months. And now that she was old and alone, she saw what Don must have meant when he called them familiars. Late in October, the year Sheila turned 80, her old mare, Bian, came up lame in her front feet. She had foundered once before. Sheila couldn't quite remember when, but maybe 10 years before. It was after Don had died, which was the marker she used for measuring time, before and after Don died. But he'd been gone almost 30 years now. So who knew how long ago Bian had had her first bout of laminitis? That other time it had been a wet, warm April, the grass leaping out of the ground faster than a horse could eat it. Spring grass, full of sugar, which for sure could give a horse laminitis. And Mike, the vet she used back then, he blamed it on that. Fall grass could be a trigger too, or that's what people said. But this has been a very dry summer, the kind they'd all become used to. No rain at all, since sometime early in May. The sky today had turned overcast, with hope of rain later on. But for now, the ground was still bone hard, and the grass in the 2-acre pastures had lately struggled just to stay alive. It wasn't founder this time, she thought. Probably not. She had been negligent when it came to cleaning Bian's feet. Bending over bothered her back. But now she bent and laboriously picked out the hooves one after the other in case there might be a stone in there. And she looked for any sign of an abscess or a bruise. But no, if it was laminitis, there'd be what Mike had called a bounding pulse. So she tried for a pulse in each of the fetlocks. But she'd never been good at it. Couldn't be sure if what she felt was her own pulse pounding in her thumb and forefinger. Mike had retired years ago. If she had to call a vet this time, it would be that young one, Helen something or other. And she knew what the woman would tell her, that she ought to get Bian started on Bute for the inflammation and pain, ought to keep Bian confined to the barn on deep bedding, ought to start soaking her hay, which would be a big pain in the butt. Sheila went up to the house and dug out the tackle box of veterinary supplies from the jumble on the back porch, found a bottle of Bute long out of date, but what the hell? Bian hated the taste of Bute, so she ground a tablet into powder, mixed it with some sherry jello powder and a dollop of applesauce, and poked the mash into the syringe she thought of as the fat squirty. When she came back down the hill with it, Bian and Russell were both standing in the paddock, sunk in afternoon boredom. Sheila held the syringe down behind her hip as she scratched the horse under her mane. Then she slung her arm around the horse's neck, took hold of the jaw, and twisted the mare's muzzle skyward as she squirted the applesauce mash into the back of her throat. Bian shook her head free, flinging off applesauce, tonguing out what she could, but some of it went down. The donkey stood off watching this whole operation with enormous interest and amusement. Sheila gave the underside of the mare's chest a good scratch. It was her favorite place to be scratched. "You know you like cherry jello," she said, though she knew the jello hadn't done much to mask the bitterness of the Bute. She mostly thought the smell of it kept Bianne from knowing what was coming. It was a small open barn, no more than 20 feet to a side, but it would take a lot of shavings to cover the whole dirt floor a few inches deep, 20 or 30 bales, maybe more. She had, counting out loud, 9 bales stacked up in the corner that she mostly used to soak up mud puddles when rainwater ran into the barn. She'd have to drive over to the food store on the mainland and bring back a load later this afternoon. She tipped a bale off the top of the stack and dragged it, grunting, into the center of the floor and cut an X in the plastic with a razor knife. The bales were only 40 pounds or so. She used to be able to muscle them around without much trouble. But last year she'd had surgery for a lumbar cyst, and it was an effort now, tipping over a bale to dump its load. The old ghosts had skittered into the dim corners when she came in, not hiding exactly, but moving into shadow, so she saw them only as soft forms, wisps of smoke or cloud. "I could use some help," she told them irritably. She straightened up, arching her sore back, before bending down to roll the bale over so the fine fur shavings slumped out through the X. When she reared up straight again, the air in the barn was suddenly stifling hot and humid. She looked over at Mike, who was crouched down feeling Bianne's fetlocks for the pulse. "You'd have to haul her into the clinic if you wanted to get an X-ray to be sure," he was saying. "But I don't think she's rotated. Ice her feet, if she'll let you, and poke a butte down her throat twice a day. Keep her off the grass, keep her in here on deep bedding. Wait and see if she's going to get better. That's about all we can do." He stood up and petted the horse on her shoulder. He was a kind man. If Sheila had been interested in marrying again, she'd have been interested in him. But she was almost 70 years old. The time for that funny business had passed long ago. Another vet might have left her to manage the bedding on her own. But Mike pitched in without waiting to be asked. He dragged a bale of chips into the middle of the floor, waited for Sheila to cut open the plastic with a razor knife, then flipped the bale and dumped it out on the dirt. And while Sheila kicked the shavings around to level out the pile, he went back for another bale. It was only May, but the weather had already turned toward summer, as it liked to do now, and they were both sweating from the light work. After he'd brought over the last bale, Mike said, "I remember when we used to get a cold day now and then." When Sheila looked up to make a smarty answer, Mike was gone, and the hot weather was gone too. It was November, and the first rain in almost 6 months had begun pattering on the old shake roof overhead. She blinked, briefly disoriented. In the dark corners of the barn, the familiar shadows sat quietly. "Well, thanks," she said to them, when she had herself squared away. She knew it didn't always work like that, but sometimes it did. She just had to ask. She went back out to Bianne, who was still standing with Russell in the drizzle. "Come inside," she said to the mare, and coaxed her into the barn with a nub of carrot. Bianne softened and lowered her neck, not quite sighing with relief, when she stepped onto the part of the floor that was now bedded. Sheila scratched under her chest a few moments, while Russell watched her from the open doorway of the barn. If she could have scratched his itchy spots, she would have, but Russell couldn't stand to be touched. He'd been mistreated somewhere along the line, and though she'd had him for more than 8 years, he was still practically feral. "Keep an eye on her," she said to the donkey. "She's old, and her feet hurt." She went up to the house and got her purse and drove the truck to the feed store in Linton, driving back with the bales of bedding. She stopped at the little convenience store at the bottom of the bridge and bought more Jell-O, raspberry this time, and a jar of applesauce in case Bien's siege of sore feet outlasted the half jar she had back at the house. And she bought a liter of Pepsi, which was one of those things she had mostly given up when they told her she was borderline diabetic. Honestly, she just liked the stuff, and sometimes she'd get a craving for it, and she'd think, what the hell, she was old. She ought to be able to eat whatever she wanted. The woman who ran the convenience store was Korean or Chinese or Vietnamese. Sheila had never known which, had always just thought of her as the old Asian, though the woman may not have been as old as Sheila. She'd been running the store since before Sheila and Don had moved onto the island. She was always curt, unsmiling. Apparently, she had never learned the knack of politeness. 1822, she said. You want bag? All these years, Sheila had come into the store with her own cloth sack, and every time the woman had asked, you want bag? Sheila pulled her purchases into her sack and went out without speaking to the woman. You don't want to be friendly? Well, me neither. On the island, there were no stoplights, only a couple of stop signs. One of the stop signs was at the Y intersection, where Shavi Island Road veered off east, and Lucy Reeder Road kept straight ahead north. Every year, people died at that intersection. People headed home drunk after partying at the nude beach. People on their damn cell phones. People in a hell of a hurry, like they all seem to be these days. For years, Sheila hadn't been able to drive through that intersection without hearing Ian McConnell, his voice over the phone, telling her Donnie had been in a wreck. Not saying he was dead, just been in a wreck. Ian had been the captain of the volunteer fire station back then. He must have seen plenty of bad wrecks, plenty of dead bodies. He'd learned the knack of skirting the question. How bad? Is he okay? And what he said to Sheila was that the EMTs were taking Donnie to Scappoose, to the hospital there, and she wouldn't want to get there ahead of them. She ought to just hold off for an hour or so, which she understood later was because they hadn't cleared the wreck yet, and Ian knew she'd have to pass through the intersection to get off the island and out to Shippo's. So she would see blood on the pavement, and Don's old Datsun pickup torn almost in half. He had wanted to save her that much. Or he'd wanted to give the EMTs time to scout around for Don's missing foot before they hauled his body away. Donnie had been 59, just 59. She'd been 50. Now she was 80, and 59 seemed like a kid. But at the time she had thought, well, at least he had a good long life. She hated to think that she had ever been that stupid. That memory didn't surface much anymore, and she might have driven through the Y this time without thinking of Don, except an idiot kid in a lowered Volkswagen rolled through the stop sign and swung onto Lucy Reeder right in front of her. She stomped the brake to keep from hitting him, skidded on the wet, oily pavement, and the sack of groceries rolled onto the floorboards as the kid shouted something, one of those curses they used all these days, or some such, and gave her the bird out his open window. And then the whole memory rose up. Ian's voice on the phone, and Don's little truck still not towed away when she drove past the site. And the other car sitting there, too, one of those big gas-guzzling SUVs. The front bumper pushed in from where it had T-boned Don's Datsun. A skinny man she didn't recognize, a guy dressed like a salesman or a lawyer, was standing next to the rig, talking and laughing with one of the firefighters. She thought of that later, when Ian met her at the hospital and told her Don was dead. The man's easy laugh. He had told Ian that it was Don who'd run the stop sign. There weren't any cameras, of course, not even in the guy's big new rig, and the county didn't have the manpower or the expertise to investigate skid marks, or whatever else might have told the straight story. Nothing ever came of it, and insurance had covered the value of the Datsun, a few $100s, without arguing whose fault it was. Long time ago now, she shook her head and said, don't out loud to clear the ghosts out of her head, though she knew it wasn't them. Time never slipped for her unless she was in the barn. It was just that stupid kid in a Volkswagen pulling her back to the day Don was killed. She drove down across the bumpy pasture, which was beginning to run with mud now from the fresh rain, parked close to the barn, and took her time unloading and spreading the bales of bedding, carrying them in one at a time, cutting a bale open, dumping it on the barn floor, arching her sore back before going back for the next one. Russell and B.M. watched her labors with minor interest. The ghosts were watching her, too, but she didn't ask them for help this time. The truth was, slipping back to that time with Mike had somewhat unsettled her. She had heard that he'd had a stroke a few months back, and she knew she should have sent him a note or stopped by to see him. He lived in a houseboat on the Wapato moorage, 10 minutes away. Why hadn't she stopped to visit with him? Bring him some of that homemade Kahlua's he liked. She had never given a flying fig if some of her neighbors thought she was a crazy old coot, but it meant something to her that Mike, who was a man of medicine, a man of science, had never so much as rolled his eyes when she told him there were old ghosts. Or anyway, ghosts was what Don had thought they were, living in her barn. And she told him what they'd been doing, moving around the barn the way they did. Mike had taken a good close look at the corners of her barn and said, well, he couldn't see them himself, but he knew there were wild things who were shy of people for good reason. Like Ishi, hiding out in the hills after all the rest of his Yahi people got killed off. Or Bigfoot, pretty good at hiding in plain sight, he said. Poor creatures just trying not to go extinct. He said the ghosts in her barn must have gotten used to her, the way wild things will do if you're around them long enough. They got familiar, Sheila said after a moment, and he nodded and said, they do. And he had taken the whole time shifting business seriously. Time might not even be real, he told her, or not like we think. Might be nothing but a turning circle, all time existing at the same time, something like that. He claimed this was something physicists had written about, people like Hawking and Einstein. Sheila didn't know if she believed what he said, time like a turning circle or whatever, but it made as much sense as anything else and made her think well of Mike, that he could believe it with his scientific mind. She spread the last bale of chips without disturbing B.N., who by this time was lying all the way flat, taking up a great amount of space on the barn floor. Russell had settled down, too, like a cat with his legs pulled under him, just outside the open barn door. Maybe the rain felt good on his unkempt hide. Sheila studied her animals a minute, but she had not stopped thinking about Mike. Strokes were right up there at the top of her list of worst ways to get old and die, and she hated being around sick old folks. And if Mike was on any kind of meds for his brain, maybe he shouldn't have alcohol anyway. But she said to the animals, I won't be gone long, and drove the truck back up the muddy hill to the house, went in, and found a stoppered bottle of Kahlua from a batch she'd made last winter, and drove over to the Wapato moorage. The parking lot was crowded. She had to park nearly to the gate and walk the long way to the ramp. She hadn't worn a hat, and by now it was raining steadily, and the floater in her right eye was a ghostly aura that drifted across the eye every time she blinked her lashes against the rain. At the top of the ramp, just as she started down, she saw the old Asian woman who ran the convenience store, starting up from the bottom. In all these years, it hadn't crossed Sheila's mind to wonder where the woman lived. But for some reason it startled her now to think the woman might live on the moorage, might be Mike's neighbor. So maybe it was that surprise or the floater in her eye or just that she should have been paying better attention, should have realized after months of dry weather that the wet wooden ramp would be slick. She was carrying a bottle of Kahlua in one hand and her purse in the other, not holding their handrail. How dumb was that? When her left foot slid from under her, she flailed her arms and almost managed to right herself, but then the right foot slid too, entangled with the left, and she went down backward, and her head hit the boards with a hard, stunned thump. She hadn't ridden Bian in years, but in earlier times, whenever she'd been thrown from her horse, she would say to Don afterward, "Well, that took the stuffing out of me," and he would know what this meant. "I'm okay. I'm not hurt." Was she okay this time? Was she hurt? She had fallen a couple of times in recent years, had sprained a wrist once, and another time broken a bone in her pinky finger, both injuries from that stupid instinct to reach out with your hands to brace the fall. But she had been holding on to the Kahlua this time, and by that same stupid instinct. So it was the bottle that had broken, not her wrist, and she could smell the sweet alcohol running onto the wet boards. Her head was ringing, her back hurt, but her back had been hurting before she fell. Her hips were her hips, okay? That was what old people always had to worry about, breaking a hip. Before she could make up her mind about it, the old Asian stood over her. "Better not get up," she said. "Wait, see where it hurts." In the same inexpressive way she always said, "You want bag?" Sheila pushed up onto her elbows. "I'm fine," she said irritably, but she was not fine. Her feet had tangled together as she fell, and her right ankle hurt like hell, a bright throbbing pain that made her reluctant to move the foot. When she took hold of the bottom rung of the ramp railing and pulled on it to haul herself upright, she could not stop a gaspy sound of agony, and the other woman then somehow positioned herself so that her bony, thin shoulder was under Sheila's armpit, supporting her like a crutch. Sheila could smell something like ginger and citrus on her breath or in her hair, stronger than the smell of the spilled Kahlua. When she was more or less erect, hanging onto the railing with a desperate grip, the woman said, "Break hip?" Matter-of-factly, so it was almost not a question. "No, damn it, I didn't break my damn hip." She wanted to step away from this woman, to stand without her support. The woman's arm around her felt almost like a hug, and she had never been one of those people who welcomed a hug. But her right foot just wouldn't take any weight. She felt pitiably helpless and was astonished and appalled when tears sprang into her eyes. "Help me back to my car," she said crossly, as if the other woman was someone she could order around. "You don't live here?" "I was going to visit someone." "No, I don't live here. Just help me to my car." The woman shifted away from her and leaned her against the ramp railing. "You wait. I bring car." Sheila didn't really want the woman driving her car, she said, just and looked around her for her dropped purse and car keys, but the woman was already striding off. "No," she called after her, "it's not." But the woman had already stopped at a little white Mitsubishi, three cars down the row. She pulled this car around and backed it up close to the top of the ramp, so the passenger side was nearest to Sheila. Got out of the car, not spry as a girl, but briskly, like a woman who had never had a lumbar cyst, never stupidly fallen and broken a foot. And she tucked her bony shoulder back under Sheila's armpit and carefully, efficiently, helped her across the short distance to the car. Sheila, hopping on her left foot to keep from stepping down on the broken one, muttered under her breath with each hesitation step, an old mantra for dealing with pain. The woman stood Sheila against the car while she opened the passenger door, leaned in, and tossed a box of tissues into the back. This being the only thing on the passenger seat, not a clutter of equine paraphernalia, crumpled food sacks, empty plastic pop bottles. When she lowered Sheila onto the seat sideways, Sheila said, "My purse, get my purse." The woman made no answer, but she left Sheila to maneuver herself and her injured foot the rest of the way into the car, and a moment later came back with the purse, tossed it onto Sheila's lap, and shut the passenger door. In the rear view, Sheila watched her hunt up a dustpan and whisk broom from one of the storage bins lined up along the top of the ramp, watched her sweep up the glass from the broken Kahlua bottle, toss the glass in the big mortgage trash can, and return the dustpan and whisk broom to the bin. Sheila thought, sure, take your time, which immediately shamed her a little. In the car, they argued briefly about where Sheila wanted to be driven. Not the hospital, no. She didn't need an X-ray. This was only a sprain. She wanted to go home. She'd be fine. She would ice the ankle, keep her foot elevated. She'd be fine. Home, please. And after a moment, the woman looked away with a slight, unconcerned shrug. Okay, where you live? At the house, as soon as the woman had delivered Sheila to her living room sofa, she knelt in front of her and said, better get you off. She took hold of the shoe by the heel and let Sheila work her foot out of it. Then she brought over an old pillow from Don's rocking chair and laid it on the coffee table, gesturing for Sheila to lift her foot onto the pillow. Better get ice on it. You got frozen peas? She didn't wait for an answer, but went off toward the kitchen. Came back with a sack of peas that she laid across the top of Sheila's already swollen foot. Then she stood back and studied her handwork. Sheila thought of offering to pay her, but stopped herself before the words came out as it occurred to her that this might be offensive. I don't know your name, she said in the car. She had not spoken a word to the woman except to tell her where to turn. Junko, she said. Like a bird. She did not say it like the bird's name, though, but with a softer, long U sound. Junko. Well, thanks, Junko. For the second time, she almost made an offer to pay her. How could she have managed any of this on her own? She'd have had to lie there in the rain until someone else came along to help her. But even with help, could she have made it all the way back to her car at the far end of the parking lot, driven home on her own? I'm Sheila, she said, and after a pause added, it's Irish, which was a stupid thing to say. Why had she said it? The woman nodded and said, okay. Sheila had no idea what that meant. Well, thanks. Thanks for bringing me home, Junko. This should have been the woman's cue to leave, but she only nodded again and went on standing there, studying Sheila. I think could be broke, your foot, she said. Sheila had thought so herself. But now that her foot was elevated and nice, the throb had begun ebbing slightly, so maybe after all the ankle wasn't broken. It's just a sprain. I'll keep off it, keep ice on it. It'll be fine. You don't have to stay. She had begun to feel irritated again. Why was this woman still standing in her living room, making no move to leave? To fill the silence, she said, if it's worse tomorrow, I'll go into a clinic. I'll get a ride with my nephew. She didn't have a nephew. She didn't know how she'd get to the clinic if she really needed to. For that matter, how would she retrieve her car from the Moorage parking lot? After her back surgery, she had taken a hired car to get home, and the driver had complained when she told him where she lived. He hadn't wanted to drive all the way out to Swavey Island. Well, animals got to be fed, the woman said abruptly. Where you keep the hay, the grain, whatever you feed them. Never mind, I figure it out. And before Sheila could say a word, she was gone. Gone down to the barn, apparently, Sheila called after her. Don't, and automatically moved to stand. But the flash of pain put an end to that. Had the woman ever seen the animals? Sheila had looked for them herself while she was waiting for Junko to unlock the house and help her inside. B.N., out of sight in the barn, probably still stretched flat on the bedding, and Russell, only a dim shape crouching by the barn door. She mumbled, no cob for B.N., giving useless instruction to a woman who by now was already down at the barn or inside the lean-to shed where the hay bales were stacked, where the sweet cob was stored in a metal garbage can. She was gone half an hour. When she came in, she slipped off her muddy shoes by the door and shook the rain off her hat and coat, hung them both on a coat hook in the entry, not planning to leave just yet, apparently. I give them flank of hay each, handful of oats for the mule, no oats for that horse. She got sore feet, and that mule need good brushing. Sheila bristled slightly. How does a woman who knows to say flake of hay and knows that a horse with laminitis should stay off sweet food, not know the difference between cob and oats or a mule and a donkey? He's a donkey, she said. He won't let me touch him. He doesn't trust people. Ah, I know some like that. After a moment, she added, people too. I seen some like that. People don't trust nobody. Did she mean herself? Did she mean Sheila? Then the woman said, you got ancestors hanging out in that barn. Matter-of-factly, not at all a question. She was looking down, brushing flakes of hay off her flannel shirt and tugging down the hem of the shirt as if she had just said, remind me the name of that book you were reading yesterday. Something as ordinary as that. When she looked up at Sheila again, her questioning expression made an answer possible. Familiars. My husband called them familiars. Old ghosts, you know? If they're somebody's ancestors, they wouldn't be mine. Maybe Multonma people? This was just their place in the old times. Junko nodded. Could be. Could be old animal ancestors, though. Your mule not afraid of them. Seems like he talking with them when I come in. It had been years since Sheila had been surprised by anything in her world. Ghosts in her barn moved time around on a Mobius strip. What more could be surprising than that? But now she thought, Russell? What? When she could, she said, you live on the moorage, Junko. You know Mike Whiteback, the veterinarian? Yeah, I know Mike. I don't live in one of them boathouses, though. Mike crazy to live down there. House gonna float off in a storm one of those days. She shrugged. Somebody said he was laid up. Couldn't drive, so I bring him groceries. He's got trouble with his right side. I teach him pigeon. Help get his ki back in balance. She gestured to Seal's foot. When your bone heal up, not good to limp around. I teach you Tai Chi. Get your balance back. Sheila ignored this. She was still thinking about Russell, talking with his animal ancestors down in the barn. Mike couldn't see them, the familiars. He thought maybe they were wild things, animals like Bigfoot, shy of people, good at hiding. Junko's mouth broadened into a slight smile, the first smile Sheila had seen on her face. In Japan, we got Yuki, Otoko, like Bigfoot. Pretty good at hiding. Nobody know if they may be animals or hairy ape men, really old ancestors. Mike never seen them. Too bad. Maybe like he said, they just shy. Good at hiding. But you saw them. She shrugged. Ki, she said, as if that explained it. When Sheila got to Mike's houseboat on the morning of the winter solstice, she handed Mike a bottle of Kahlua and said, if you're not allowed booze, I guess you can pass it along to one of your neighbors. There was a droop to one of Mike's eyes, his smile slightly off-center, a sag at the corner of his mouth, and this all gave Sheila a funny qualm, the same feeling she always got when she saw something gruesome. But he was still Mike, still himself. He said, not a chance, took the bottle from her and limped off toward the kitchen. He flourished the bottle in Junko's direction as he passed through the living room. She looked up and nodded and said, after. She was shoving furniture to the walls to make room for the three of them to practice Tai Chi. Later, after Bian had recovered from her bout of sore feet, Junko and Sheila mostly practiced in Sheila's barn. The footing in the barn wasn't the best, but Junko said the uneven dirt floor was good for Sheila's balance. And often when they were halfway through the form, maybe stepping backward into word off monkey, or in a bow stance leaning into box both ears, time would shift and they'd be somewhere else. Sometimes they were just younger, before Sheila's lumbar cyst, before the arthritis. Sometimes they were just younger before Sheila's, before the arthritis in Junko's knees. Young enough to sweep really low into snake creeps down. But other times the oaks would be young, and if it was winter, the field would be a shallow lake. Or spring, and the sky above the island clouded with thousands and thousands of migrating sandhill cranes, swans, geese, white and gray ducks. Their cries and calls a vast continuous cacophony of sound. If it was night, the sky would be an impossibly dense field of stars. Sheila and Junko weren't alive then. were familiars themselves when they helped a young man lift his dead wife in a canoe into the branches of trees at the downstream tip of the island, and when they joined the woman harvesting wapato, digging into the mud of the pond with their feet to bring up the tubers. There were 15 villages and 2,000 Multnomah people living on the island in those days. But later, when they watched a white man building the barn where they would later practice Tai Chi, the Multnomah no longer existed as a distinct tribe or a people. Once they helped a child bury the body of her dog under the oaks, but this was when the oaks were old, near the end of their lives, and there was nothing left of Sheila's house but a remnant of foundation. There were again vast clouds of birds above the island and slender shoots of new trees growing in the meager soil that had been Sheila's bedroom. It was the birds and those thin young trees that made Sheila think of what Mike had said, that maybe there was no such thing as time, that maybe there were only moments, each with its own story. More and Less and New by Amy Ogden. When Yara lands on Apollyano, a dead Beguin greets her at the shuttle landing pad. She introduces herself as Ev when she greets Yaro first time visiting the Beguini. She doesn't say outright that she's dead, but Yaro can tell by the papery texture of her skin, the soft purple fuzz of mycelium that covers Ev's face and the backs of her hands. She's heard the stories, even played through the zombie nuns' attack sims, just like everyone else back home. She figured she would see a dead Beguin or two in her time here, just perhaps not so soon. Some come to visit and some come to stay, Ev says, and moves stiffly to pick up the half-empty rucksack that Yaro threw together as she fled. She'd left almost before she'd fully decided that she needed to go. The first moment her sister's attention was occupied elsewhere, with the riots on Focas 3. A Beguin's life is supposed to be a simple one, anyway. What would she have done here with the sim suit, the glazed porcelain tea service, the electric armor rig? Take all the time you need to decide what is right for you. Yaro stares in sick fascination at the dark red high fey under the pale skin of Ev's temples. They could almost pass for veins if she didn't know better. So it's not already too late? Ev smiles, one side of her mouth jerkily lifting a second before the other. The fungus grows slowly. It takes weeks before the symbiosis is complete and self-sustaining. She gestures ahead of herself toward the line of personal habitats, crowded side by side along the inside of the dome. One of these will be Yaro's, and she despairs of how she'll ever be able to tell which is hers in the jumble of doors and windows. In the meantime, you may notice some strange sensory effects, phantom scents, sounds, dreams that feel real, but you have time. Yaro follows her down the wending path into the Beguinage. She expected something much older looking, like the ancient monastery on Morix, with its solar shingles and great concentric rings. These structures can't have been built more than 100 years ago. The oldest buildings have the blocky, simplistic structure of that period, with more organic lines and materials incorporated as the colony grew outward from its origins. Nothing elaborate, built for survival, first, with small comforts and community spaces only growing in to fill the gaps later. And now this simple dome encompasses her whole life for as long as she chooses, or she thinks, glancing at Ev, perhaps a bit longer than that. And once the symbiosis is complete, it's irreversible? There are drugs, but they're hard on your body as well as the infection, Ev says. The words are neither warning nor reassuring, a simple statement of fact. If Yarrow hadn't been looking for things that seemed off, she might not have even noticed the unevenness of Eb's gait, the slight drag of one foot. It's up to you to decide what you fear more, what you'll become if you stay, or what they'll make of you if you go back. Yarrow stills. No time to falsify names or travel documents. She'd hoped, somehow, that her family's name wouldn't have followed her out to this far corner of the universe. You know who I am? We know who you were, Yarrow. Eb shrugs, and Yarrow realizes that we is both singular and plural, not the greater Begonage, but of herself. Then you know my sister will come for me when she figures out where I've gone. Thick tendrils of confession try to grope their way up Yarrow's throat. Her sister, the warlord, is not a good or gentle woman. Neither is Yarrow, for that matter. Docile is not another word for gentle. In lieu of self-recrimination, she says, I know too much for her to just let me go. Ev puts her hand on Yarrow's shoulder, moving her along the path again. Then it's up to you what she will find when she follows you. Over the next few days, Yarrow finds herself less confounded by the Beguinage's strange layout than she'd expected. The branching network of paths aren't as chaotic as they seem. She is never too far from a garden, an eating hall, an infirmary. Either she's learning her way around, or the first spores in her head are already at their work. In between her shifts in the laundry or the kitchens, she checks herself in her pocket mirror, watching for purple to thread its way through the fine dark hairs on the backs of her arms. She isn't used to physical labor of this sort, and she sleeps more soundly than she would have hoped. Usually, she doesn't remember her dreams, but when she does, they are of the warlord's arrival in fire and fury, the burning bodies of 100 Benguines lighting the way to Yarrow's hiding place. At the very heart of the Benguinage is a garden, and at the heart of the garden is a fungal mass, blood red and pulsing. Yarrow's wandering brings her to it regularly if she doesn't mindfully avoid it. All paths lead here. Indeed, she finds herself drawn here when she has free time, carried either by her own curiosity or fungal thrall. If she looks closely, she can see white bones tangled deep in the fringed thick threads. One day, Ev is there when she arrives, kneeling beside the throbbing mass, whispering things that Yarrow cannot hear and does not want to. It sounds like praying, though Ev has been clear that the fungus is not the Beguin's idea of God. Communion, then, an oral meditation. Yarrow lingers on the garden's margins, wondering if this communication cuts both ways. Whose voice would the mass use if it could speak? It's not immortality, Ev says. Her chin lifts from her chest, but she doesn't look at Yarrow. Without Ev's living body, our system can't be indefinitely maintained. Yarrow swallows. Then what? Then we'll be reabsorbed into the rhizome. Ev indicates the fungal mass. And the rhizome will be more than it was before us, and we will be less. And that is Yarrow's future, too, if she wants it. She doesn't know what she wants. The kitchen mother to whom Yarrow is assigned is half Yarrow's age. It should rankle, but her sister is younger than her, too, and it's hard to muster any offense. As the kitchen mother, the one responsible for feeding everyone who lives in this corner of the Beguinage, she spends most of her time planning meals, coordinating with the gardeners, setting up duty rosters. But most days she can also be found elbows deep in the sink, or chopping capsicum, or sweeping. Yarrow imagines the warlord wielding a broom, but of course, in her sister's hands, even a broom could become a weapon. Even Yarrow could. The kitchen mother sings what sounds like hymns, whenever she works, and Yarrow recognizes some of them. Soaring melodies, stolid words about the six faces of the turning god. When she asks, isn't it sacrilege to sing the songs of the constellary temples here? The kitchen mother only laughs. The fungus has its own harmonies that you can't yet detect. Scents, pheromones, that sort of thing. She directs her broom at a stubborn pile of crumbs in the corner. But there's still joy in the songs we grew up singing. Yarrow, peeling sweet potatoes, is not as mindful of her fingers as she should be while she watches the kitchen mother work. She nicks herself a glancing blow and blots the blood that wells up in the corner of her apron. What drove you here? She asks, a question she has no right to ask. And yet, our sibling pod died in the attack on Azhoshal. The kitchen mother leans on her broom, her back to Yarrow. She doesn't see Yarrow's fingers curl around the handle of the peeling knife again. Dayan was at university in the Quarak cluster. She lays one hand on her own shoulder. And so Dayan, alone, survived. The warlord perpetrated that attack, said Yarrow, through numb lips. Yes, we know. I was there too. Yes, we suspected. They stand in silence more. Then the kitchen mother moves off again, the broom making broad strokes over the wood floor. Yarrow picks up another sweet potato, one that's almost too big to hold. I don't deserve to stay here alongside you. The kitchen mother laughs, a surprised sound, without cruelty. What made you think you ever could? Deserving doesn't come into it. Yarrow's blade tears a jagged wound deep into the potato's orange flesh. You wouldn't have said that if you'd been there on that day, if you saw the wreckage we made of your kin. No, we don't imagine so. The kitchen mother pauses to meet Yarrow's eyes. But we are here now, and so are you. The blood on Yarrow's apron dries muddy brown and doesn't wash out when it goes through the laundry. 2 weeks later, Yarrow has strange dreams. Dreams where her sister's favorite warship lands, crushing the garden next to the little landing pad, and her sister herself storms down the ramp with 20 armed guards in tow. She dreams that 100 beguines crowd the paths down in the beguinage, blocking the way, and that Ebb stands at their fore. There are stories told about people who come to this place bearing weapons, she says. And Yarrow's sister laughs and says, unlike some, I've never believed in fairy stories. And Yarrow dreams of the roar of plasma rifles and the stench of scorched flesh, and she dreams of beguines that fall out but that stand up again, walking inexorably toward the warship as they walk each day with their baskets of laundry and their bushels of carrots. And when they open their mouths, hymns rise up from their tongues on clouds of purple-black smoke. She dreams that the invaders fall back until, one by one, they simply fall. She dreams of the rhizome and the bleached white bones that work their way outward from its heart. In the morning, the bells ring to wake her for breakfast. Ev meets her at the eating hall. What is left of Ev, what used to be Ev, and will soon be something new and more and less. Part of her shoulder is missing, a hole edged with blaster burns. Good morning, she says, and smiles with only half of her mouth. Yarrow puts her hand on the table to hold herself upright. If I spoke to the rhizome, she whispers, or if I go into it one day, will she be there? No, gently. Ev touches the back of Yarrow's hand, and Yarrow doesn't recoil from the touch. Her flesh feeds the rhizome, but her mind is lost. Today, the purple fuzz on her face has faded to gray. The red of the mycelium has gone more brown than red. Her shuttle is still here if you want it. Are you staying for breakfast? Yes, Yarrow whispers. Her hand leaves the table to fold into Ebb's. Yes, I'll stay.